Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our podcast today is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong's RegTech Lab, the HKU Standard Chartered Foundation FinTech Academy, and the Asia Global Institute, as well as the HKU edX Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from the university's Faculty of Law. ESG. The acronym stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. These days, few topics are as perhaps vexatious and polarizing, with legendary investors like Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and others saying it should be something that isn't really considered in when making investment decisions. Our guest today is Los Angeles-based John Solizarno of the law firm Vinson & Elkins, where he serves as counsel and co-head of the firm's ESG task force. Prior to that, he was senior director for legal and corporate development at the Clorox Company. In addition to being a strategic, experienced lawyer and a thought leader with significant expertise in M&A, corporate governance, ESG, securities regulation, corporate and business development, as well as consumer products, technology, human capital management, business financial strategy, and international matters at high growth startups. He's also worked for Fortune 500 companies, and hopefully he's going to shed some light on the topic of ESG for us today. John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, we all had our own paths to law school, but I mean, where are you from originally? Where did you grow up? How did you end up in the legal profession? And perhaps more, most germane to this discussion, how did you end up as a lawyer in the field of ESG?
I'm born and raised in California, where I'm currently sitting right now. I had a fairly vague idea what I wanted to be when I was a grown up, and law school kind of seemed like a logical place for me to figure it out. I thought for some time I might end up being like a diplomat or working for the United Nations or something along those lines. And when I was at law school at Columbia University in New York, I became very passionate about corporate law. It was not actually something that I had a lot of familiarity with growing up. I didn't kind of grow up in or around finance people or Wall Street, but I became very fascinated with just how corporations are set up, how corporate governance works, how the kind of interplay between shareholders and the board of directors and management. So that became very fascinating to me in law school. And I turned that fascination into a practice of mergers and acquisitions. So I worked at Skadden Arps, which is a large law firm in New York City, for a number of years doing M&A. I eventually made my way back to California, where I worked at Orrick, Carrington, and Sutcliffe, also doing M&A and a little bit more venture work. They're based in San Francisco. It was kind of at the time that the Silicon Valley startup scene was getting really hot in the early 2010s. But over time, I ended up transitioning to an in-house role where I first started off as securities counsel at a biotech company. And then I made my way to Clorox, which you already mentioned, which for those of your listeners, Clorox is a multinational consumer packaged goods company, primarily domestic focused in the US, but we have operations and products all over the world. When I was at Clorox, I actually wore a number of different hats, including I was the general counsel for a period of time for our EMEA region, which included the APAC region. So I have a pretty good familiarity with some of the local laws and considerations of that region. We had joint ventures in Asia, in the Middle East. We had operations in Europe. So I worked closely with all of our international business partners there. My role transitioned over time while I was at Clorox, and I was there for about 8 years, I started supporting the board of directors of, you know, Clorox is a Fortune 500 company. And so our board, is held in quite high esteem. And I stepped into the role around 2015 as assistant corporate secretary. So that part of that role also involved engagement with our shareholders. Helping the board do all of the things that a board does, you know, preparing for meetings and, you know, helping disclosures for proxy statements, but also helping our board lead, you know, engagements with our investors. And that was right at the time that this acronym ESG was starting to gain traction. So our investors were
moving on from, you know, asking kind of pretty basic questions around good corporate governance, like how long are, you know, your directors, do they serve on the board, or what your compensation programs look like? And they were starting to really transition a little bit more into understanding how the board was overseeing the key risks facing the enterprise. And that conversation was really evolving to, you know, talking about things that were germane to that company in particular. And so that was everything from climate change to, you know, plastics and waste, which is very important for a consumer packaged goods company, you know, human capital management, or just basically how you're treating your workers. And of course, that sort of dovetails into diversity, equity, inclusion, and any number of other topics. And so it was a really fascinating time to be having these conversations, primarily with the large institutional investors who, you know, historically, in my background as a corporate lawyer, I really thought of the world through the lens of shareholder value, shareholder value, shareholder value. And that means just sort of maximizing the economic return for your shareholders. And now there was a little bit more demand or curiosity about how the company was thinking about its other stakeholders, while kind of doing that through a lens of helping the shareholders over time. Because if you're managing your stakeholders appropriately, your shareholders will certainly benefit from that. And so it was a really fascinating time to step into that role. And that's kind of how I became an ESG expert. I think I'd say, and like anyone who's in the ESG field, nobody sort of came into this field intentionally. There were different paths to it. I happened to kind of step into the role at the right time to kind of develop the expertise right as it was really evolving and developing.
You know, I first became aware of ESG as middle of the last decade when I was on the regulatory beat at Thomson Reuters. And what struck me was, compared to the other acronym or the dish du jour of the last decade, which was CSR, that when it came to ESG, regulators took it seriously, and there were actual definable metrics that you could gauge an entity on. Whereas with CSR, you know, the claim was, and this is, you know, certain consulting firms and PR firms that were asked to help firms undertake CSR programs organization-wide for them, was that at best, it's an inadequate form of charity, and at worst, it's a disingenuous form of public relations. That was the view of CSR. But ESG, even then, it struck me, it was a different animal. It had more edge to it, it had more bite to it, and it was more meaningful in terms of the change it sought to effectuate. Why does ESG matter?
Yeah, no, I mean it's a great question, and I think that there's a lot of confusion about these very interrelated terms. And you know, ESG, if you kind of go back to its history, it's really fundamentally focused on the investor, which is where I think there's a bit of differentiation between how CSR kind of views the world, and I think, you know, as you mentioned, can be a bit of a PR marketing type of approach to the world, whereas ESG is really intended to help investors understand the risks in their portfolio and to help quantify the risks and to some degree the opportunities, and really translate that into a better understanding of you know, the performance of their portfolios. So ESG is really intended to drive value for investors, whereas I think CSR is intended to sort of paint a pretty picture of what a company's up to for their various stakeholders. And, you know, within the ESG kind of framework, there are more concrete disclosure obligations to help your investor base understand, and seeking sort of comparable information that is investment useful is what the intent of ESG is. We'll probably get into this in a bit, but I think one of the challenges with ESG is it's sort of evolved, whether that was by design or just kind of mistake, to mean more than it was intended to be. And it's become a little bit problematic at how, I think, broad the ESG sort of acronym or initials have become to be understood broadly by people. But at its fundamental level, it's a very focused way to kind of almost think of things like, you know, a credit score or something that will help you understand
the risk of an investment. Beyond that, you know, people start thinking of it as, you know, impact investing or other things that it's not. And so I think that it's sort of morphed into something that it was never intended to be. But at its core, it's really just meant to help investors understand the risk profile within their investments.
I mean, there is a growing body of research that seems to suggest that those organizations that score well on ESG, however you define it, whatever the yardstick happens to be, broadly speaking, those that tend to do well when it comes to ESG tend to be better run companies, and they tend to provide better returns, and that amongst younger investors, that is something that's front of mind. Older generations maybe less so. So, I mean, in terms of the value of ESG, I think the case is becoming increasingly compelling. But then you've got these multiple acronyms, and you know, you've got CSR, you've got ESG, DEI. People say they're all interrelated in terms of if we look at it in terms of the common thread of, you know, social justice, and then the corporations have a duty to be responsible social actors in the communities in which they operate, and it is not just the old Anglo-American capitalist mindset of increasing returns to shareholder value and nothing else. That increasingly the continental European, German, Scandinavian notion of communitarian capitalism, of not just shareholders but stakeholders, societal stakeholders also mattering in the equation, is something that needs to be factored in. Apparently that's the common thread connecting all three. What do you see as the common thread, or is it wrong to look at it that way?
I mean, I certainly think that these are interrelated, and there's definitely some common threads, but I think that it would be a misstatement to sort of say that ESG and CSR are synonymous. I think that if you look at the Venn diagram of the two, there's clearly a lot of overlap. You know, DEI, I also think is a component of both of them as well. I think it is really important to understand that I think capitalism and sort of the folks who are driving capitalism have come to the awareness that maybe the Milton Friedman school of thinking has perhaps been a little bit short-sighted. There, you know, certainly I don't think most proponents of ESG would argue that
the Chicago school.
I don't think that most proponents would posit that you shouldn't be seeking shareholder return. However, I think there's a recognition that through kind of our pursuit of shareholder return, there are these externalities that have certainly kind of stacked up. And those externalities, when you look at the kind of macro economy, and do potentially have some significant risks to your investment over time. So maybe I could talk a little bit about the fact that there has been this transition of capital to institutional investors. I think there's definitely been like a bit of a accumulation or concentration within some very sort of small group of very large institutional investors. And those institutional investors basically hold the entire market. So I'm talking about the BlackRocks, the Vanguards, the State Streets, and other institutional investors who hold large positions in almost every Fortune 500 company, almost every Russell 3000 company. They are basically diversified holdings of the entire economy. And I think they recognize that maybe some of the spillovers, some of these rents that have essentially flowed because of the singular pursuit of shareholder return has now potentially led to some unintended consequences. And while capitalism is not meant to sort of right that wrong, it needs to sort of keep in mind all of the externalities that are stacking up. And so, for instance, climate change is a notable one. In a world where, you know, the global temperatures are rising, or all of the things that, you know, folks and scientists are saying are going to happen,
that's going to have a detrimental effect on, you know, the sort of economic viability of a company in, you know, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, certainly in 30, 40 years. And so what they are looking for is to have companies, you know, articulate what those risks to the company might be so they have a better understanding so that they can construct their portfolios in a way that diversifies against those things. I think that, you know, going back to what the difference between the acronyms is, CSR, I'm a little bit of a pessimist. I think, you know, a lot of CSR programs for years have wanted to just kind of paint a pretty picture of what their company is doing. And I understand it. And it's, so there's certainly some marketing value to communicating to your stakeholders, whether that's your employees or your customers, what the company is doing, you know, for the benefit of society or the benefit of the planet. But that's different than helping an investor understand how risky their investment is. And that's fundamentally what ESG is. DEI, the other kind of acronym that has gotten a bit of a challenging reputation in the last year or two, especially in the United States. I think that the premise of DEI is really that more diverse workforces or management teams or boards. And when I say diverse, it can mean any number of facets. It could be, you know, gender, ethnic diversity, but it could also be diversity of thought. I think that the thinking there is the more diverse an organization is, the better business outcomes will arise. And that's because you've got different perspectives that will lead to kind of different critical thinking and not groupthink situations. You'll also potentially have higher levels of employee engagement or sort of just a better work environment. And that, you know, if you think about it in the ESG context, leads to more shareholder value because lower turnover, happier workers, more thoughtful kind of business decisions leads to more shareholder return. Whereas from a, if you're looking at DEI through a CSR landscape, you know, that's kind of talking about what you're doing in your communities or how you're helping, you know, various underserved communities. And maybe that's the right thing to do. And I certainly, you know, I'm a proponent of doing the right thing for sure, but that doesn't necessarily translate to shareholder return. So I think that you kind of need to disaggregate CSR and ESG. And I think DEI kind of fits into both of those.
Personally, I've always been skeptical of CSR because, I mean, certainly the way it played out when people were jumping on the bandwagon about a decade ago from when it had its heyday from, I don't know what, 2009 till about 2020, that when people were jumping on the bandwagon, I mean, it was just such a cash grab. I mean, you saw so many consulting outfits and one body in this region with CSR in its name that you'll remain nameless, though I think I may just have given it away. These folks were going around to companies. He's saying, well, you're not doing this right, you're not doing that right, but have I got the thing for you? And if you hire me, and I will fix all your CSR problems. And it became such a cash grab. And frankly, it was a cash grab for a while. I mean, those that did well made out like bandits on the back of it.
Yeah, and maybe I can just add on to that, you know, as a practicing attorney, I mean, I've seen that evolution. I've actually worked in organizations that had CSR programs, and I didn't get involved in it too much as an attorney. But in retrospect, there's a lot of concern that I think, you know, practitioners really should be watching out for, especially those who are working with companies, because there's a lot of statements, you know, these glossy reports with windmills and smiling children. Those are largely PR exercises, and there's a lot of stuff that's been said in there that may not be substantiated. And, you know, you can call it greenwashing or you can call it some, you know, other, you know, maybe pessimistic terms, but especially in certain areas where there's a highly litigious environment, like in the United States, as regulations are ramping up, you got to be very concerned about some of the statements that have been made historically that might not be substantiated. And now they are gathering scrutiny and frankly, they're gathering lawsuits. Because some of the things just weren't really grounded in reality. And so that's one of my concerns with CSR as a concept is I think it was a kind of seen as a no regrets marketing exercise that every company was doing. And there was probably a cash grab for some of these advisors. But now it's put companies in a pretty difficult position where
Now that the regulatory environment is catching up, and certainly the plaintiff's bar has realized this may be an area for scrutiny, this is going to be a headache for a lot of companies to kind of navigate these sort of competing interests.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the, I forget which U.S. Supreme Court case it was, which laid down the bespeaks caution doctrine. But yeah, that does come to mind when it comes to some of the fanciful things some companies were claiming. But then we come back to ESG, and given that good governance goes to the bottom line, I mean, I think that's not in dispute. In the post-Enron, post-Sarbanes-Oxley world, I think the connection between good governance and shareholder value is clear now. But if that's the case, why has ESG gotten such a bad rap lately?
That's the question I am answering basically on a daily basis. Especially,
I mean, and why do the mainstream media sources, which know better, even entertain such art?
Well, I first of all, I do think it has gotten a bad rap. I think it's true, but I think it's an overstated issue, because I think fundamentally, I don't think ESG, any credible investor still believes fundamentally in what ESG stands for. Now, whether or not they'll use the acronym is maybe a slightly different question. You know, Larry Fink, who's...
But the metrics are useful. The metrics are useful. The barometers, the yardsticks are useful in terms of gauging risk and good
absolutely.
Governance.
Now, I also do think that there has been a bit of a cottage industry of, you know, some of these ESG ratings firms who maybe have some kind of opaque, you know, methodologies and have been sort of selling their wares. But I think fundamentally the core tenets of ESG are just as relevant, if not more relevant than ever. It's gotten a bad rap because I think there's been a bit of a concerted effort from certain kind of political sides to sort of push against it, because I think there was a view that some of the pro ESG forces that have kind of been pushing for a number of years and sort of infiltrating corporate America to really be speaking about things that have been perceived as progressive or liberal ideologies. And now that's become kind of the corporations are doing things that couldn't get done in the ballot boxes, especially in the United States, which is the jurisdiction I'm the most familiar with. I think that has led to significant pushback, you know, calling some of these practices like woke ideologies that these corporations are pushing, or they're pushing climate change pseudoscience, and they're really just kind of pushing a liberal agenda as opposed to doing what they should be doing, which is, you know, seeking maximization of shareholder value. Now, that's the argument. I think fundamentally, ESG is just as critical as ever. I think it's going to get rebranded. I think people are kind of talking about things a little bit more directly linking the value of a specific thing that they're doing to the shareholder value that they're ultimately seeking to achieve. And so I think, you know, there's probably a bit of maybe green hushing, where companies are still doing what they were doing, but they're maybe talking a little less vocally about it. Or if they're talking about it, as I think perhaps they should say, we are doing X, Y, and Z thing because X, Y, and Z thing lead to specific, you know, value for our company, as opposed to kind of this conflation of CSR and ESG that I think had started to take hold in the last couple of years. So I think that's where the bad rap has come, but I don't think that it has fundamentally changed anything. I think that, you know, the institutional investors and even kind of some of the active investors truly do believe that this is really just prudent business and prudent risk management. And I think that they want to ensure that the companies that they're invested in are employing the appropriate structures, governance, oversight to implement all of the various E and S things that are material to a given business.
What you say is true, that to label someone woke in this day and age, I mean, it's such an emotive, charged epithet. It's like calling someone communist or a socialist during the Cold War. And indeed, elections were won in some cases by labeling one's opponent as such. back then. So we need to be cautious about such terminology. But you know, when you speak to the financial sector and multinational corporation executives, certainly in this time, Hong Kong, off the record, the topic of ESG, in my opinion, it draws sneers and indifference from many of them. I mean, certainly in Hong Kong and Singapore, I mean, and notwithstanding what their organizations say in public, I mean, one local banker said to me in January of last year, let me read you a quote, because I jotted this down as we met for drinks that night, and this is what he said. He said, a decade ago, they went on incessantly about corporate social responsibility. We scarcely hear about that these days. Before that, following the Enron WorldCom scandals in the States, it was all about corporate governance and the tone at the top, 24/7, nonstop. The global financial crisis kicked things into high gear. Bottom line, ESG is the dish du jour and the flavor of the month. Like all of the woke, socially conscious fads before it, it will hit its high water mark, and then we'll move on to the next pressing issue of the day, the pet cause of the moment. There are some well-meaning people in society who need a cause because they need to feel they're making a difference. Oftentimes, when they learn to compromise and work within the system, they do make things better, but incrementally. Slow and steady is the way to do it. At other times, there are those with an activist streak who are trying to fill the emptiness in their own lives or repair their own damaged psyches by trying to help others, and it's often counterproductive. End quote. Now, this was a prominent local banker who said this to me. I'm not going to name names because he's still around. But when people with that kind of wealth and power and clout say things like that, I mean, to me, it's dangerous to society at large when powerful people hold such condescending, flippant attitudes. But I guess what I'm wondering is, how do you combat such indifference and ignorance and, dare I say, cavalier recklessness when people in positions of wealth and power have no incentive to change? You're not gonna persuade them. You're not gonna dissuade them, because the status quo seems to be just fine.
Right, it's a really interesting question, and it's definitely, you know, a perspective that you heard from your contact that I've heard many times. I think what I would say is that they're not wrong in the sense that, like, why should I care? Like, I understand that. But I think there's been a bit of a transition that I don't know people are fully cognizant of, and maybe you're hearing the news, but ESG up until very recently has been solely driven by voluntary disclosures. That has really been how it's been communicated to investors. So if I believe something is important and I'm hearing from my investors that they want to hear about these certain things, I'll tell them the things that they want to hear. And so that's where there's been, I think, a little bit of kind of a blurred line between CSR and ESG, where it kind of has been a bit about marketing. What's happened, I would say, in the last 18 months, really, is while you kind of got this backlash to ESG, you're seeing the regulators really sort of, you know, sharpening their pencils, and just there's been significant regulatory overlays onto in markets all over the world. So Europe, you see the CSRD. Just this past week in the United States, the SEC dropped its final climate reporting rules. In my home state of California, there's mandatory climate disclosures. I understand that, you know, I'm not a lawyer in APAC, but I understand that mainland China has just also at least proposed or possibly passed new ESG regulations. I think that there's going to be this confluence of mandatory ESG disclosures and requirements that, whether or not you believe in it, whether or not you think it's important or prudent for the business to be doing some of these things, every company is going to have to start gathering this data. They're going to have to be assuring this data. They're going to be working with their audit firms. They're going to be having to answer to the fact that this information now needs to be filed with various regulatory bodies. And so you might think that it's the flavor of the day or this, you know, whatever kind of the next thing is going to come along. But there's some urgency to all of this. And I think that some of the regulatory pressures are being driven by the demands from their own sort of political constituencies to address sort of existential issues like climate change, for instance. So kind of this slow and steady progress, I think, is being viewed as insufficient, and the regulatory bodies are really starting to drive this. And I think that that's going to be kind of the next frontier is, you know, this incrementalism might not be kind of how this progresses, because there's going to be the significant demand for mandatory regulatory disclosures. And what those disclosures will do is kind of create like-for-like comparators that you currently don't see. So, you know, peers within an industry, it's hard to tell, like, what one company's carbon footprint is or one company's, you know, employee turnover is. But if those are mandatory disclosures, you start seeing those things, and that can actually drive behavior change, I think, within a company. And whether or not you think that's good or bad, I think it's just kind of the way that it's going to be. And so that I think that is going to drive corporate behavior. So I respectfully kind of disagree with the quote that your contact said, because I don't think that you can disregard these things. And kind of going back to the Chicago school that I alluded to earlier, I think sort of capitalism, the Milton Friedman school of thought, is, you know, seek to maximize shareholder return within the rules of the game. I think the rules of the game are changing. And that's kind of what I think the reality is that everyone needs to understand, is that the regulatory pressures and the overlapping regulatory regimes are going to force every company, especially multinational companies, to really come to grips with these overlapping demands on their business. And they're going to have to get very precise on some of the disclosures, the data gathering, the assurance processes. And it's going to be a cost on a business for sure. But I think that, you know, the investors who are driving some of the demand from these regulatory bodies are also seeking this. So I think it's going to be a brave new world. And I just don't know that incremental change, and kind of we'll move on to the next flavor, is how it's necessarily going to be in the future.
As luck would have it, the banker in question that I spoke to did indeed get his MBA at the University of Chicago. So he went to the Booth School of Business. So it's not surprising, though, from what I knew of him.
Yep.
He held those views long before. I mean, I don't think getting the degree indoctrinated him being in that environment, but being sometimes it's a self-selecting sample.
Sure.
Like-minded people gravitate towards each other. And so, I mean, a certain type, for example, goes to George Mason University.
Certainly.
I mean, if you're a libertarian bent, that's probably the place for you to be. But, you know, I mean, when mainstream publications even start giving such positions, credence, I mean, case in point, about a year ago, Candice DeMont, a French editor with the Economist Intelligence Unit, published a white paper, and we'll be including links to these on the website. But she published a white paper entitled "Pushing Back, Moving Forward: Understanding the Evolution of ESG," and this was under the Economist Impact imprint that they, for their thought leadership and white papers. She argued that ESG factors have moved from a niche investor issue to a mainstream corporate focus, but she said that ESG may undermine business performance. I read that, and I'm like, so okay, if that's the case, what are the prospects for ESG in a world facing socioeconomic uncertainty and geopolitical tumult? That when people are in survival mode, do they perhaps care more about investment yield than solving the world's other problems?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, one of the things that I didn't really mention kind of at the outset when talking about kind of the ESG sort of blowback in the last couple of years, I think that it's sort of easy to be pro-ESG in a low interest rate environment, or kind of where there's little macroeconomic challenges. But, you know, when we saw the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that spiked, you know, energy prices significantly. And suddenly some of the energy companies that had kind of been maybe, you know, viewed as on their way out, and you know, they had kind of seen a lot of shareholder rebellion against them in the years leading up to it, all of a sudden they were outperforming the market.
And so it does certainly complicate the argument that ESG is this unequivocal good, and clearly this is the way of the future. Because I think it's a very messy picture. But I do think that if you take the long view on all of this, you know, you're going to have sort of a cyclical situation from year to year where, you know, interest rates will be where they are and inflation will be where it is. And the companies that are managing their long-term risk and communicating that to the shareholders will, I think, on balance, outperform. And I think that there's probably also something to be said for companies doing the right thing. And now how do you decide what the right thing is? But I think that there's sort of an innate sense that doing good by your stakeholders will be good for your shareholders. And so keeping track of those things and not just unapologetically just pursuing every last cent, because that's not necessarily good for business and it's not good for a sustainable business. And by sustainable, I don't necessarily mean environmentally sustainable. I mean a business that can sustain itself. So I think that the tenets of ESG will continue to remain front of mind for investors. They might stop using that acronym. And frankly, I don't know if the label that I apply to my own task force that I lead at my law firm will continue to be called the ESG task force. But I think there will always be some level of needing to communicate to your shareholders what you're doing properly. And so I don't think that that's going to go away. It's just going to change shape.
Has the ESG label been tainted, do you think, indelibly? I mean, is it maybe not as bad as the swastika? I mean, and some of the Buddhists and Hindus who get grief in the U.S. for using it in their worship, even though it predates, you know, the Nazi Party. But is it one of those things that it's so indelibly tied in the minds of people to woke and woke is bad, therefore it's time for a new term. In much the same way, the term liberal was tarnished in the latter half of the 20th century in the 60s with the rise of the new left and all of that. That ESG has been so contaminated, it's been so marred, a new label has to be developed for the next generation.
Yeah, so I definitely think that it has been marred to some degree. I don't know how lasting that sort of mark will be. I mean, it itself may sort of survive kind of the kind of political crosswinds, like, and so, you know, I'm very, you know, US focused here, and you know, we obviously have a big election coming up. I think that maybe some of the heat will probably subside a little bit after that. And I don't know if some of the talking points that you're hearing from, you know, various sides of the spectrum will abate following that. If there's a change of administration or the same administration, maybe that'll change. I also do think, and you know, I've been hearing for years, maybe ESG needs a rebrand. And I've always been kind of the mind that it should never have led with the E in the first place. It should have been probably GES or GSE, because governance is core. I mean, all of this should really be driven by governance. And I'm a governance lawyer. I like to think of the G, and sometimes I colloquially just say that it's the glue that holds it all together. And that's a pretty inoffensive thing to talk about, governance. That's a pretty neutral thing, and I think everybody can get behind that. So maybe that's one way to rebrand it if it does need to be rebranded. The other thing I've heard recently is maybe we should be calling it rational sustainability or strategic sustainability or something that's a little bit more clearly draws the line between what the business is doing to the purpose of the business, and that it's, you know, rational to its economic viability or rational or strategic to what it's doing as an organization. And it's less about this kind of acronym. I do think that people glom onto shorthand and you know, three-letter or four-letter acronyms can get a bad rap just because they can start to mean whatever you want them to mean. But, you know, would rebranding help the movement? Perhaps. I think it's a little... I've seen these political winds blow, and I don't know that a rebrand necessarily is going to change anything, but I also don't think that the fundamental precepts underlying it are going to go anywhere either. So maybe people are going to start talking about it slightly differently. I'm not sure.
Well, I agree. I don't think, I mean, these things take on a life of their own. They become memes, and I don't think memes are a substitute for a meaningful social discourse. But yeah, I mean, if you were to lead with the governance, then yeah, that goes back to the whole notion of, you know, what we've been hearing about, or what I've been hearing about, all these compliance and regulatory events I've been attending over the years, you know, about the tone of the top. Harp on that ad nauseum. And so, yeah, if governance means anything, if the tone of the top means anything, then yeah, it all goes back to good governance. It all flows from that. And in terms of what you were saying about rational sustainability, I mean, I think that would be an apt appellation, because it's descriptive, it's functional, it gets the heart of the matter, as opposed to terms that are perhaps broader in their scope of what they might potentially mean. And when that's the case, meanings become malleable. People can craft their own narratives, and that's when demonization of certain terms can take place. That is counterproductive. But again, we have to stress, ESG does mean something. It has edge to it. It has bite to it, particularly because the matter has been raised to a level now that regulators and policymakers are taking notice. And there are consequences in some places for not meeting those requirements. So from your perspective, to what extent do ESG mandates intersect with financial regulation? And why should banking and financial institutions globally take ESG seriously? It's as seriously as they do with their routine regulatory compliance and risk management requirements, because people have said it needs to be elevated to that level.
I don't know that the data is yet mature enough to have that level of kind of precision. I mean, the challenge with ESG is the data is very company specific, or even the risks or the issues are very company specific. It's a little different than like your financial statements, which you can read are fairly comparable from company to company. I mean, some might have non-GAAP measures or whatever, but I think that fundamentally you can kind of compare like to like in the financial context. Right now, I don't think that ESG information is yet at that level of maturity, because every sector has very different material issues. Every company within a sector has its own particular issues at play. And so it's hard to sort of compare those things. Now, I'm not trying to get, you know, the financial teams off the hook, because I think that they are going to have to prepare for a world where that information is just as scrutinized, and it will probably evolve to that level, I think, in, you know, the next couple of years. But right now, I think we're kind of in the data gathering phase of the journey for ESG type of issues. So as you're seeing kind of these regulators sort of forcing this new disclosure regimes onto corporates who do, you know, work in various parts of the world, that is kind of step one, I think. And then it will kind of come to data comparability, data assurance, and then sort of being able to compare companies against each other. And there will also be some scrutiny from the various stakeholders or regulators, like as to inaccurate or incomplete or misleading information. I don't think we're there yet, because we're still kind of slowly emerging from this voluntary world. But once it starts becoming mandatory, and I think we've seen a few years pass under, and we've laughed over those reporting periods, you're going to start seeing, I think, some comparability and some scrutiny that is very different than what we're currently experiencing in the environmental, social, and governance world. So I guess I would say, don't get too comfortable with the fact that I believe that they're distinct enough that you don't need to worry about it as much. But I think in the future, you know, companies will need to be just as laser focused on these issues as they are with financial metrics.
So if we're looking ahead a decade from now, would we be having a different conversation about the state of ESG? I don't mean to sound morbid, but as more of the older generation die off, and as more people from the generation Y and Z cohorts come of age, start to take more of the helm of society, they start to move up the ranks, middle management and beyond. And since it polls suggest it does matter to them, ESG does matter to them, that would that be the cascade effect that shifts society?
I think it could be. I mean, I haven't really spoken to the macro generational issues that I think are clearly at play here. You know, one of the things that's driving a lot of ESG performance for some companies who view this as an opportunity or a place to differentiate themselves is they know that they're essentially leaving money on the table if they're not addressing the needs of their ever younger constituencies, whether that's looking to be a more desirable employer for places, people who want to work at a place that, you know, is aligned with their values, or they want to buy products from a company that aligns with their values. Those same people are going to move their way up through management companies. They're going to move their way up through regulatory organizations. I think that there will certainly be a generational shift. And I don't necessarily think it's more, but I think it's just a reality of this, that the old guard will change. I think this is a story kind of as old as time. The Gen Xers that maybe are kind of really sort of maturing into decision-making roles are younger than the boomers, and they have a different set of priorities. And I think the millennials are kind of similarly kind of moving along. And I think that all of those things will change the tone. But I also think that there's going to be some pretty acute issues going on in the world that are going to really kind of bring some of the urgency to the fore, whether that's, you know, the reality of a changing climate or some of the very disruptive things that like AI is going to bring. And is that going to change kind of how the workforce, sees itself and frankly, the economies generally? I think all of those things are going to be coming together at the same time, and it's going to lead to some pretty complex things. It's hard for me to forecast, but I do think generationally that is going to be a huge driver in this conversation in the next 10, 20, 50, 30 years from now.
Okay. And any tips, any advice you would have for our students in the law school of HKU or legal or business students at any institution for that matter, in terms of perhaps charting a career path for themselves in the field of ESG how much should they think of ESG again as they grow up, as they mature, as they make financial investment decisions? I mean, how much of a yardstick, how much of a barometer would you say ESG should be in their decisions, or will the choice be made for them? I mean, as some fund managers have said to me, ESG is already built into many of the products we sell. So I guess there's an investment component to my question, as well as a career path aspect to it. What are your thoughts? What guidance would you give them, if any?
One thing I would just say is, I don't know that ESG as kind of a standalone thing is necessarily going to exist in the future. The type of practice that I have right now, I don't know if that is going to be, something long-term that is going to be an ESG practitioner. I think that ESG considerations are going to be integrated into everything that people do. And so what I view my role is really kind of bringing those concepts into the everyday decision making of all kinds of different practitioners, whether it's an M&A practitioner or, a CFO or whatever, just so that they understand that every decision needs to be made with that lens as opposed to, the ESG practice. And so I think that the fundamental issues underlying ESG, good governance, thoughtful oversight of critical risk to a business, thinking through some of the externalities that their business might have on the world or society at large, or how those
risks are going to impact the company. I think all of those things need to be more thoughtfully integrated into every business decision. So I think everyone in the law school or in business school will kind of be an ESG practitioner in some respects, but they might not necessarily have an ESG title. So I would say that is kind of point one. Point two is the world evolves very fast. I mean, I'm not that old, and it wasn't that long ago that I was in law school, and we weren't talking about any of this. I was learning, you know, really basic fiduciary duties under Delaware law, very cut and dry. You have duty to your shareholders. Maybe there's a few times that you can consider other stakeholders. And that paradigm has shifted dramatically, I'd say, in the last 10 years. And so I can imagine that that is going to be the same for the folks who are coming up. But, you know, the third point I would also make is it's important to do what you find passion in. And so if there's a way to kind of marry what you're passionate with, whether, you know, that's environmental sustainability and also pursuing a career in law or finance, I think there's definitely some value in doing that. And I do think that kind of in general, a lot of people in the younger generations will be doing that. And so there's going to be demands on a lot of employers to make sure that they're aligning their business practices with the expectations of the younger workforce as they kind of come into to kind of displace some of the older folks. So I think that it's a very, I have a very optimistic view on kind of the next generation taking the reins. But, you know, just be very true to who you are and pursue what drives passion. Because I think that there are successful paths out there, and you just need to understand that it might not look like it looks now, because it never looks the same over any period of time. So, but it's a very exciting space to be in.
I agree, and you're right. The paradigm has definitely shifted from mere director's duties and the business judgment rule. I mean, I remember when I started law school in '99. At that time, I mean, you know, yeah, social. There were some social justice types on campus, and they were pleasant people. But it seemed more like a fringe thing. You know, the general consensus was some people would be more productive if they worked within the system. But I mean, again, these debates. I think are older than either of us, and they can go on forever. But was there anything else that you wanted to say before we closed out? Any final impressions you wanted to leave our listeners with?
No, I mean, I think this has been a very hopefully fascinating discussion. What I personally find very interesting about this is, you know, I used to be a practitioner in a space that was fairly well-worn. Doing work in the ESG space, I'm constantly, like every day, I have to be very up on the news. I have to be very up on some new regulatory regime that just announced something. You cannot rest on your laurels. There's no sort of tried and true path here. You're building the plane as it flies. And it's not necessarily for the faint of heart, but it's a very exciting space to be in. And so, I personally find it very rewarding, and I'm just excited to see where it goes. And it's not going to be smooth, but it'll be an interesting ride.
Does it make it tougher to be a lawyer in a cutting edge field?
I think so. I don't think it's for everyone. I know that for a fact. I mean, I've worked with some summer associates who were like, thanks, this isn't for me. I'm going to go, you know, work in, you know, structured finance or whatever.
Well, they know the rules. Well, they know what's expected of them. They know what the rules are.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, I maybe personally have my own work style is a little bit more. I like to think of myself as a dot connector,
yeah,
as opposed to sort of give me a checklist and I'll follow it. I like to sort of connect, you know, things that might not necessarily be clearly interrelated and find the interrelations and make sure that they're sort of being appropriately addressed or articulated. So it might not be the field for everyone, but for me, it's personally something that I find very interesting, very rewarding, very exciting, because it allows me to be kind of creative in a field that, in a legal field where creativity is not always, you know, very apparently a way to proceed. This, I think, requires some level of creativity and a willingness to be comfortable in the unknown, because there's a ton of unknown here.
Certainly, it's nice to know that there are areas in the law that where there's still room for intellectual exploration.
Yeah,
and thinking outside of the box, as opposed to your more established, well-trodden areas of law where the law is largely settled and the lines are pretty clear. But John Solorzano, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, so thank you for having me.
Let's do it again. And to our listeners, thank you. Until next time.